everyone. This is Dr. Will Tuttle, and I want to thank all of you for joining us on the third Friday of the month. This is our third Thursday World Peace Diet Circle call, and we're having it on the third Friday today from the wilds of Arizona. We're down in the Tucson area and in the desert, although it's been raining for the last few days. I mean, there's lots of water here. And I want to thank all of you for joining us on the call. So this is Friday, February 16th, 2018. And last night, on Thursday evening, as I informed everyone, I hope you got the message that we had a lecture here in Tucson that was sponsored and organized, really, by Robert Mutzer, who is a World Peace Diet facilitator here in the area, and it was just a tremendous success. It really went well, and we couldn't change the date after we got it scheduled. So thank you all for being flexible with your schedules. If you know anyone who wasn't able to make it tonight, as you know, all the calls are recorded. And so it's been a whirlwind tour since the last time we all spoke together, which was the third Thursday in January. And we just got back not too long ago from doing, I think it was 16 lectures in 12 days in Florida, and then came back to San Diego and did some lectures there. And then now we're in Arizona doing a series of lectures here in Tucson, as well as Phoenix, Tempe, I think, and also we'll be going up to Sedona and doing some lectures there, and also in Prescott before we come back to California. So it's wonderful to be able to work together with like-minded people to help spread this message, and that's what we're doing right now. We have a sacred time. So, to me, it's sacred. It's a special opportunity that we have once a month to share our ideas and thoughts. So please remember that you can at any time press star 6 on your phone if there's an issue that you would like to just hear about or talk about, or something unresolved or a question or something you'd like to share that may be of interest to other people who are also on the same page here. This is all, as you know, this is for people in the World Peace Diet Circle program, World Peace Diet facilitators who've gone through the training or who are going through the training. And so it's we're all not only vegans, but also on the same page as far as the World Peace Diet approach, which includes the big picture of our culture's mistreatment of animals for food as a cultural phenomenon, and also the spiritual and psychological, historical dimensions. And so I think it's very empowering and liberating to have this deeper view of our society and of ourselves, and to use our time during this lifetime that we have to help in the healing process. I think that's really what it all comes down to in many ways. There's certainly a lot of emotions that get involved with this whole thing, and outrage and sadness and so forth, and frustration with the way things are. And people who are not yet with us on the same page are experiencing just a numbness, really, in many ways, and disconnectedness, and also frustration. And so the idea is to connect with the love that is in our hearts, the caring, the kindness, and the mercy that we see, and then that we feel naturally, I think, as spiritual beings. And then to find effective ways to allow this to move into our shared cultural experience to help others and to help animals and to help ecosystems and all living beings. Bless you all. Thanks so much for coming to this call, into this space, a space of love and respect that we have online, I guess, or in the telephone world. And again, remember star 6 if you have a question or comment. So I'd like to begin by inviting all of us to turn our attention within. We usually like to do that at the beginning of the call and take a few minutes to center ourselves and to feeling our connection with this beautiful earth. Ah, it's such a beautiful planet that we're on. It's just feeling our connection with all that the earth represents to us. And also connecting with heaven, the infinite creative power, and connecting with silence. I think it's very powerful to just be together in silence and to savor this moment where people from all over North America, I think primarily it's North America, since other time zones it's kind of difficult at this time, but I may be wrong, there may be people from who knows where on this call right now, and to just savor this moment, feeling our hearts open to the higher wisdom that is ever-present to guide us in our lives, and feeling our hearts open also to caring for all of our relations, for the non-human animals that we share this beautiful earth with, and for all the other human beings, and especially the human beings who are working hard to help bring healing to our world and to join with us in raising consciousness about the devastating impact of animal agriculture, the enormous blessing of moving to a plant-based way of eating and living, practice of compassion and empathy and kindness, and feeling our connection also with the movement within the deep consciousness of humanity to awaken from this old hypnotic trance of violence and eating violence and causing violence and abuse and coming back home to our true nature. Great. It's happening. So we give thanks for this precious opportunity that we have to join together on this call. We give thanks for each other, for all our loved ones, for the whole community of activists and advocates for animals and for justice and equality for all living beings. And we give thanks knowing that all the ripples that radiate out into the infinite web of relations from our being together this evening will be to bring healing and peace into our world. And so it is. All right, so here we are. And it's another wonderful opportunity we have. And we're one time zone over, so we had to get adjusted to that. And I apologize for not sending out a notification about this call earlier today. We went out and just got back a little while ago. We visited, I mentioned Robin Motzer, who's a WPSI facilitator here in Tucson, and who also volunteers at the Tucson Wildlife Center. So we went there, and it was quite interesting. I'll just maybe say a few words about that, because it's on my mind, and I think it relates quite a bit, actually, to a lot of the challenges that we face and the opportunities that we face. But you know, she volunteers at the Wildlife Center, which is dedicated to helping wildlife, to help animals and birds of all kinds, and all animals, snakes and coyotes and skunks and opossums and javelinas and deer and all the various types of birds, roadrunners and hawks and owls and eagles and canyon wrens and whoever it is, all the different wild animals. Basically, that are in this area, they service apparently a very large area, the whole southern Arizona. And so we went there at Robin's invitation at 2 o'clock this afternoon. There was a lecture and a slideshow by a woman who's really spent her whole life just being out with animals and has all kinds of stories of her interactions with mountain lions, coyotes, with deer, with birds, with roadrunners, and all different animals, and is very knowledgeable and had lots of great tips for seeing animals and for being a good influence, really, I guess, on other people and on animals. And some of her tips were basic things, but they're good things to remember, like if you go out into nature to see animals, the importance of, before you go, quiet your mind and to get into a place of harmony, inner peace, a sense of joy and gratitude. Because she was saying, and I think it was very interesting, she spent, you know, the last 40 years refining her ability to be with animals. And she said animals can read our thoughts. They know if we're upset and they'll stay away. They can feel the energy of human beings. And she said most people go out into nature and we act so differently than animals. Animals are they're at home. So they're just there. They maybe walk a little bit here, chew on a few leaves, walk a little bit over there, look around, listen, walk over there. You know, they're just kind of being. And typically, you know, humans come into nature and we're marching. We're marching across the landscape and we're going somewhere. And so they instantly, you know, scatter and try to stay far away so that we never see them. She said most people never see really the animals. We are always being seen by them, she was saying, but they're watching us, but we don't see them, or they smell us or hear us, but we don't smell or hear or see them typically. So she was advocating some things that I really agree with, you know, deeply as a Zen practitioner, and also just as someone who loves, Madeline and I love to get out in nature, and it's always a treat to see animals in the wild. And but she talked about, you know, how very often we do things that are to animals very rude, you know, very that scare them or make them feel they need to stay away or defend themselves, you know, either run or do something. And some of them you can think of it. She was talking about how, for example, if you see animals and you just look at them, that this looking at animals and they see us looking at them, kind of like staring at them, is perceived by them as extremely threatening, typically. That's not something that she said is a good idea. The best thing is to kind of turn your head and turn your body so you're not facing toward them and just look sort of out of the corner of your eye so that they don't feel like you're invading their space and looking at them. And she said when she does that, she's able to get very, very close to animals and just they kind of forget that she's even there. And I think there's a lot of truth to a lot of what she's saying. I mean, I think, you know, every situation is unique and there may be times when it's totally fine to do that. But it is, in general, be aware of looking. I'm not staring at animals. She also was saying not pointing at them, you know, that looks it's threatening, and also not smiling, because really what we're doing is we're baring our teeth. And usually you see an animal, we start smiling and staring at them and pointing, and they feel like that's very rude behavior, and you're baring our teeth. And so in general, to kind of have a quiet mind. And the other thing she was saying is to sit down and just be in nature and not go somewhere, but just be there and be with them. And just be there, and eventually they'll begin to manifest. Also, to not wear scents, fragrances that are strong. And we've noticed that nowadays, I don't know what the laundry detergent companies are up to, but the laundry detergents have such piercing chemical smells nowadays that even us with our much less refined sense of smell than most animals have, and smell people coming from far away just because they're wearing laundry. I mean, they've laundered their clothes in the last day or two. We can smell them coming. And so I think that's one thing. And another thing, the dryer sheets too. I mean, all that stuff, it's very powerful fragrances. So to just mask the fragrances, not to wear them, not to make noises, you know, just to try to make noises that are similar to what the animals make. And so I really liked her basic attitude of fitting in to nature and thinking how animals think rather than in a different way. However, the thing that was interesting was after it was over, we talked a little bit, and she's obviously extremely concerned about the welfare of animals, of wildlife, and was talking about how the droughts have been devastating. A lot of the birds are just not giving birth, like the quails are just not giving birth because when there's not enough water, there really wasn't enough rain this past winter. And so the leafy greens are not that thick and lush. And so the quails who eat those apparently didn't get enough like they usually do, and so their vitamin A level is low. So what the scientists figured out, and so they're not, when that happens, they don't give birth. They don't give birth, and they don't have eggs and babies. It's, I guess, a survival kind of thing. But so anyway, she was saying that the birth rates are way down for most of the animals and birds in general, and that's because of the dryness and the heat here in the desert. It's very unusual. It hasn't been like this for decades. So so she's very concerned about that, and also about the, you know, the human violence. And then everyone at the Wildlife Center, you know, all the volunteers as well as the staff, of course, that's their whole thing. They really care deeply about wildlife. 80 to 90% of all of the cases that come there, and they say about 3,000 a year coming in of injured animals, 3,000 injured animals. And about 80 to 90% of all of the injured animals, it's directly due to human beings doing something to them, either directly, like poisoning them, trapping them. They get caught in traps inadvertently, but it's some kind of human thing shooting them. They get wounded by gunfire or by bow and arrow kind of thing, or being hit by cars is huge. Flying into glass, of course, is something that happens in our windows. But it's basically human interactions that are injuring these animals. And so after it was over, we had quite an interesting talk with her, with the speaker, and then also with Robin. And this is the thing we run into. Like, you know, she was so concerned about animals. And so I thought, well, it'd be great. I'll talk to her a little bit about the work that we're doing. And I told her we're on a nationwide lecture tour promoting veganism. And we think that that's, you know, such an important part of protecting wildlife. And I could already see she was a little bit, sort of contracted a little bit when she heard the word vegan, you know, and but she was still kind of smiling and sort of there, you know. But I could sense a shift, and I just explained to her, you know, it's so great, you know, because when we move to a completely plant-based way of eating, we're no longer supporting the devastation of wildlife habitat, which is done by animal agriculture. And we talked about how we, you know, just coming across California to Tucson, we saw these massive operations where the Colorado River doesn't even reach Mexico anymore. All the water is sucked out into these irrigation canals to grow these vast monocrop fields of corn, soy, and other grains to feed to these animals. And we saw these huge feedlots and how the ranchers are, you know, basically destroying the habitat. The destruction of habitat by grazing is well understood, and she knows it. She for sure knows it. And the destruction of habitat by growing all this grain and not having all the water being sucked dry and all the irrigation that's needed. The water tables are dropping, and there's so many. I mean, just the whole idea that the global climate destabilization and warming as contributed to primarily by animal agriculture. I didn't mention that, but I mentioned the things I just mentioned now about animal agriculture, and also I mentioned the USDA's Department of Wildlife Services that's spending millions of our dollars every year killing literally millions of animals, of the coyotes and bobcats and mountain lions and all kinds of other smaller animals like the, you know, skunks and opossums and otters and so forth, because ranchers see all these other animals as pests. And you know, she just looked at me, you know, and Madeline was right next to me, looked at us, and she continued smiling and nodding her head, but the next thing she said was a complete non sequitur. She said, "Yeah, you're right. It's really weird. Some people go out into the desert to watch animals, and they're wearing a headband that's made out of a rattlesnake skin, and you know that just doesn't make sense. You know, you shouldn't be wearing a headband made out of a rattlesnake skin." And then she kind of ended this conversation and started talking to other people, and I could just see that this, you know, had nothing to do with what I was talking about. I was talking about eating meat and dairy products. That's what I was talking about. And so then we had quite a conversation with Robin, and this is something we've seen, you know, this is definitely not an isolated case, but Robin was just sharing how This is a, you know, a whole wildlife center that's devoted to wildlife, you know, devoted to protecting ecosystems and the integrity of ecosystems and habitat for animals and, you know, climate stability and water, fresh water, you know, all that. And what do they do? She's the only vegan there. I mean, not the only vegetarian there. I mean, there's nobody. In fact, she's being bullied, she said, and, you know, because she tries to just in a respectful way to share the benefits of plant-based diet for wildlife and for habitat. And so, in just a couple of weeks, they're having their big annual fundraiser. And you know, they're advertising it. So I asked her, what are they serving for food for the fundraiser for the donors? You know, it's $150 a plate, and it's a big fundraiser where they make their money. And she said there's beef and salmon. You know, and these are people who care about wildlife. And yet, Robin tried to talk to the director about the fact that this is really going really contrary to their mission, and encouraging people to do the very thing that's destroying wildlife more than anything by far. I mean, the worst possible thing, ranchers and animal agriculture, it's a war against wildlife on every level. It's a direct war of the government is just trapping, poisoning, denning, shooting, animals, you know, massively. I mean, it's a massive direct killing operation, plus indirectly the destruction of habitat and water and soil, degrading. And we see it whenever they have these barbed wire fences up where cattle are allowed to roam, all of the native flora is wiped out. There's no saguaro cactuses. The riparian habitats are destroyed and trampled. The water, the streams that were running, you know, a few hundred years ago before animal agriculture came here are all dried up. You know, I mean, it's really, you know. So she explains this to the, and the director says, "Listen, you know, we need to please our donors. The donors want to eat meat. We're not going to make them serve them some kind of vegan thing, and they're not happy. And then we don't get the money. Then that ruins everything." And so this is the situation that I've spoken to people who are volunteering in humane societies where, you know, people are there because they love dogs and cats and horses and other animals, but they have, during their fundraisers, they serve beef and chicken and pork and salmon and so forth. The very things that are, again, creating the mindset of violence and exploitation and abuse of animals. And so there's certainly the question comes up in our minds, what do we do in this situation? You know, do we continue to try to work with people, or do we say, no, this is not worth it. It's too heartbreaking. Because she talked about how, you know, she put up some information that was just, you know, very just helpful information, a little flyer. And one of the staff people said that she found it offensive and took it down. You know, and so people, that if we bring up the fact that we think veganism or eating a plant-based diet for ethical reasons and for wildlife at a wildlife center, that they find that is offensive. And she said she's been, you know, she feels like that she can't at all talk about this, and if she does, they treat her very badly. So, I'm just wondering what you all think about this, and if you have any thoughts or questions, but any advice or ideas. I think, you know, that the idea, another thing she explained too, which I see everywhere, which is a huge problem, is the enormous power of the local fish and game departments. Every state has these fish and game departments, and the fish and game departments, you know, they get their money from people who have hunting licenses and fishing licenses, and they're basically fishing and hunting people themselves that are on the Fish and Game Committee, and they use the money, plus they get taxpayer money on top of it, and they use these funds, millions of dollars, to promote hunting and fishing. That's what they do. They promote hunting and fishing, even though a lot of people that are coming in to the wildlife refuge are there because they've swallowed, you know, like fish who have swallowed fish hooks, I mean, excuse me, birds with swallowed by hooks, or animals who have been shot and have their legs broken by bullets or arrows by hunters. You know, they end up being brought in, you know, but the whole thing is run by the Fish and Game. And she said it's really a nightmare, bureaucratically, to have your organization be basically, you know, everything has to be done according to the way Fish and Game wants them to do it. And she was talking about how the javelinas, these beautiful little animals that come in injured, they're not allowed to release them in the wild. You know, they release all the animals. They have these wonderful facilities and animals come in injured to treat their wounds and then release them again. And they're not allowed to release javelinas because they're considered a pest by the ranchers or by the homeowners. So they have to take them away to Phoenix. They brought up to Phoenix, and then they don't know what happens to them. They very well could go to canned hunting facilities or places where they're definitely going to be shot, or who knows where. So this is something that's rampant. I mean, we've seen it. People who are activists trying to reduce hunting are up against an entrenched bureaucracy that is in place and has been in place for hundreds of years to see animals as mere entertainment, just shoot them for fun, kill them, eat them, and if they get in the way in any way, get rid of them. You know, that basic mentality. And a lot of people talk about how, you know, really, if you do, it's interesting to do research into the way that Fish and Game and the DNR, Department of Natural Resources in every state, and how they work together to make it better for hunters and anglers, and fishermen, fisheries where they stock ponds so that there's more fish in there for the fishermen. They do control burns so that browse will grow up in the early spring in order to artificially inflate herd deer populations with hunters. I mean, these are standard procedures that are conducted all over the country, especially in the eastern, you know, east of the Rockies where there's more rain. And so I think, you know, people don't realize, you know, what's going on behind the scenes and how this is operating. And the thing is, in many ways, that the ranchers and the hunters, they are getting more desperate, I think, or more aggressive. You know, numbers of people hunting is just shrinking and shrinking. And also people are eating less meat, especially cow meat. So they're getting, I think, in many ways, more aggressive in asserting their right to the land and to the public resources. You know, these animals, we see them when we're traveling. It's really heartbreaking. You know, we were just, as we came across from Southern California into Arizona, it's a very bleak desert, really. I mean, it's so dry. And there's crisscrossed everywhere with these huge irrigation canals, all kinds of irrigation canals from the Colorado River. And to see how, like I said, the river is just completely sucked dry, and to see these just massive, massive acreage of grain and grass and hay and for these animals, and then to see the massive size of these feedlots with cows, and they stink. I mean, the smell is incredible, is horrific. And I just think, you know, how could we be so extremely stupid as human beings to do this? I mean, this, if we use this water wisely, we could make a whole web of beautiful, small garden, you know, like in Russia, Dutchess, you know, these garden plots, like people could have an acre or two and growing fruits and vegetables and potatoes, sweet potatoes, and, you know, really we could have this most beautiful web of villages and harmony with nature. So with all these irrigation canals, I mean, I think we should let more water go into the ocean, but, you know, some of it maybe could be used. And we could make just a beautiful world. We have the capacity to do that. And to see how instead of that, we have all these people making resources to make meat, typically Japanese fish feedlots, and people driving by, and the average person driving by does not look for the same idea. They just see, oh, this is great, you know, the cows are out here, and they stop and have a burger at McDonald's and go on. And so the whole system, in a way, it's not working. It's destroying ecosystems. It's creating all kinds of food shortages and disease and environmental devastation, and wildlife numbers continue to plummet. The numbers of wild birds and other animals continues to drop. And, again, climate continues to get more destabilized. And we can see that it's not working on that level. But then I was thinking about it, from the point of view of the individual actors involved, it's working pretty well. The guy that's playing Pila, it's working great for him. And the people who are supplying, the farmers who are supplying all the grain, it's working for them. And the people who are running McDonald's and Burger King, it's working for them. And the people who run the pharmaceutical and medical establishment, it's working for them. So all along the way, it's just the bankers, it's working for them. And the Monsanto and Cargill, these big operators and the chemical companies, it's working great for them too. So that's the thing. I mean, the media, it's working well for those individual, the small kind of wealthy elite interests. But to just see this unfolding and then to see how the people you would think would really care and try to make a positive change end up using enormous quantities of money and resources to save a few animals. But in the meantime, millions upon millions are being slaughtered, and they don't say a word about it. And in fact, they even encourage it. I mean, they go and eat meat and dairy products and never say a word about it and won't let you talk about it. And so I can understand Robin's frustration, our frustration, of course, with that. And like I say, we've seen it in every state, in every country, really. I mean, this is something that activists have to deal with on a continuous basis. And I think ultimately, what Madeline and I feel when we feel into this is that it's really wiser overall to keep promoting veganism, moving to a plant-based diet. That's the underlying sort of foundational change that will help everything change, and also to work with people who are somewhat open to the message. Because if we don't do that, then we can fight really hard against these people who have entrenched interests. But if we do that, we're going to probably get more frustrated. So I think, and I know it's great, I think, for Robin to work hard and put on the event we had last night, and we packed, it was a packed house. A lot of people said that they, learned a lot, and we met people who said that they, last time we were here, they went vegan because of hearing the lecture and reading the book. And I think as more people actually go vegan, that creates a whole reservoir of wisdom and of energy that will help bring in change. And so it's just a matter of reaching critical mass and working to help reach that critical mass. And every day we can plant seeds in order to help us to do that. So again, if any of you have any thoughts about this or unique insights into these kinds of dilemmas, I think we really, more and more now we need to work with people who do care about animals and find ways to reach them. And one of the huge problems, I see it all the time actually, is the power of donors. People who are making donations basically get to decide what these nonprofit groups are going to do, right? Or the nonprofit groups are so beholden to the donors. Donors want to eat meat, so okay, we can't say anything against that. And the donors want to have us make larger cages, and you can't say anything against that. We've got to do that. And so to be able to be independent, and do whatever the heck we want, say, speak our mind and go forward and do what we want to do, but also to get donations, that's a hard thing, because you know, we start, you know, and these organizations, you know, I've seen it happen so much. I don't want to blame any organizations, but I can see I've seen the number of organizations start out really small and idealistic, and pretty soon they get big and fat and have lots of money coming in, and they've kind of moved in with the industries, and they're not questioning the industries like they used to, or promoting the vegan message like they did in the beginning. So those are some things. I noticed that we do have a hand raised by Lily. So I'm going to stop here for a minute, and I'm going to go ahead and unmute Lily's phone and see what Lily has to contribute here. Thanks. Are you there?
Hi, Will.
Yeah.
What you said brought something to mind about, I've been studying, you know, the early life of this country before white men came. And even though the Indians in New Mexico and Arizona were not vegan, what you described, having gardens and all of these things, that's the way they actually lived, because they were not herders. They learned the herding culture from the white man. And so they had beautiful gardens. And even the Mexicans that were there, they didn't eat meat on that level. I've been reading a lot of books about what people do to the animals they do to each other, because that's the premise of the whole world peace diet. And as you know, I'm a student and a teacher of that book. So I absolutely go along with it. And it's just the descriptions of the beautiful, beautiful gardens that they had. Yes, they did do some hunting, but everything was in balance, as we well know. And actually, the whole idea is to actually go back to the way it was. Everything you're witnessing in the Southwest has to do with greed and consumption on a massive scale. And of course, you could say, well, when the Indians were here, there wasn't the population that was here either. That's true. But if people were taught to do a different way of living, we could feed everyone, and that place that you were in that was so desolate would be a garden again.
Yeah, it could be. That's why I could really see that.
It could be, because it once was, and it could be. It's just being used and abused by, you know, McDonald's. And I want you to know you get garbled every so often. I don't know if you're on a computer or what, but every so often, I don't know if that's happening to anyone else, but that's what's happening to us. But that's all I had to say about that, because it brought it to mind, because this country was like, this whole country, well, the whole world, but this country itself, before the white man came, really was a Garden of Eden.
Yeah, beautiful. Since you're on the line, can you maybe just tell everybody, because I was going to ask you to just say a few words, we didn't get to it last couple of months, you're about the World Peace Diet Sunday is going on. I've heard some really good things about it. I've been meeting some people recently, and they said, oh, yeah, I've been getting on the World Peace Diet Sunday and really enjoying it. And so I just want to kind of let everybody hear that.
Well, sure.
Where are you?
You know, I mean, I think most of the people on this call know that exists.
Know about it, yeah.
It's, what's good about it is that I read it very carefully, and I kind of make some commentary that is, you know, pertinent to what was read. And then other people chime in and make their own comments if they want to. So it becomes very cohesive, and we become a vegan fellowship. And it's also good for people who are not vegan, because they hear other people's experience. And it's just, some people, this is my fifth year of doing it, I can't believe it. And we're getting down to the, we may or may not finish chapter 13, Evolve or Dissolve, which is all about the ethics and spirituality of being vegan. And I write a weekly missive. Anybody who wants to be on that, I can tell you where we are, and I also write a little reflection on where we are.
Right.
And I didn't know that I was not an ethical person before I was a vegan. I thought I was highly ethical, and that's the situation that we are up against. People do not think that their food choices are unethical and not compassionate. They don't think that, well, they may not think that they're compassionate, but they certainly don't. If you were to go up to anyone who's not a vegan and say, well, the way you're eating is not ethical, they would just look at you like you had two heads and would walk away. You can't even confront people like that, and I wouldn't dream of doing that. But I myself, until I read The World Peace Diet, which is now over 11 years ago, and went vegan within the first couple of chapters, I didn't know I was not an ethical person. And now I look back, and it just feels so unethical. And, of course, that's what PETA's name is about, you know, people for the ethical treatment of animals. But I didn't know anything about that. And that's what we're dealing with. Like, the, you know, I kind of seethe when I hear about nature centers like what you went to. Because those people are just, they're just so locked in. They're just locked in. And if they could just get the education, are willing to deliver themselves to it. And that's what I try to do on the World Peace Diet. Every Sunday, I've been doing it now. This is my fifth year of doing it. Every Sunday, I want to leave even someone who comes there once with some idea of what you're trying to say, because every page of your book says it. So I, you know, even if I don't believe in cruising through the book and picking things out, you're not going to get the full transformation if you do that. But if you come to the study group and bring other people to it, and even non-vegans to it, I started it for non-vegans because I wanted them to get the message like I did. I didn't start out being a vegan. The World Peace Diet is my reason for being vegan. So that's why I do it. I do it every Sunday, 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific time. And sometimes people call in from God knows where. It's a worldwide call. It's a free call. It's a free call if you have long-distance service or minutes on your cell. It's a free call. I don't charge anything for it. The payment I get is when people call me and say, you know, because of your call, I've really started thinking, I'm really planning to change my way of living. That's the payment I get. That's what I live for.
Right. That's the best thing. Wow. Well, thanks so much, Lily. It's a tremendous gift, I feel, that you're giving to animals and to our world by continuing with this call and creating a community of activists. And like
and
you said,
everyone on your call can get to your website, right? And the number and the times and everything are right on there. Is it still on your itinerary?
Yeah, the itinerary is the place where it's just at the very top of the page. If you just go to worldpeacediet.com and just click on upcoming events, I always have it at the very top, and it has the dates, you know, I mean, the hours, times, and the phone number to call in. So I think, it's a great thing to recommend to people who are maybe just beginning to be vegan or not vegan yet, or people who are strong vegans and just want to be able to have other perspectives and learn more about it. And from time to time, we enjoy joining you on the call, and we're planning on doing that in a couple of weeks, too, to talk about...
Right, March 4th,
March 4th, right. It'll be before
March
4th, the
wonderful.
One. We're going to talk a little bit about the, some of our experiences with the one, especially the Southern California, the Cal Poly. And I see those kinds of things happening all the time, actually, yeah.
Well, I love the call because there are people, you know, I can count them off, and people that have just said to me, I'm vegan now because of this call, or I'm a stronger vegan because of this call. And I said, well, yeah, that's because, and I didn't read the World Peace Diet, but because of this call, I did. So that makes me feel good. It makes me feel like it's not totally hopeless. It feels like it is, but I don't think it is. I think miracles are possible, and we're all miracles. All of us who have seen the light and have become vegan are, to me, it's a miracle that I've now, going on 12 years of being a vegan, who knew? You pick up a book, and all of a sudden, you're someone else. You didn't know you were, so thanks, Will. I'll hang up. I'll be quiet now. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks so much, Lily. All our best to you and to Jim. Thanks.
Thank you, and to you and Madeline on your travels. Thank you.
Right. Thanks. Yeah. Okay. So, I did want to say, again, press star 6 if you'd like to contribute anything or have a question or comment. This just came all up for us the last couple of days as we traveled to Tucson, and we drove from Southern California, and it's so in your face. It's so obvious. I guess that's the thing, the ugliness, the horrific stench, the destruction of the land, of animals, of people's lives, and how it just goes on indiscriminately. It's like this war machine, this war against nature. And to just see it so obviously, I guess it's very, very fresh. And a couple other things I wanted to just mention on the call that we have this month, too. We were in February last month, we were in Southern Florida at the Hippocrates Institute, which is pretty famous as a healing center using completely plant-based food. Very, you know, living. It's all raw. I would say 80% is sprouts. You're eating basically 80% sprouts, and then a few other, maybe a little bit of cucumber and a little bit of maybe avocado, but it's basically sprouts. And so Brian Clement, who's been running that, is really, I think, created a fantastic community there. It's all vegan, and it's based on healing. And there's hundreds of people going through Hippocrates all the time from all over the world, especially from Europe, who come there because of serious illness, various forms of cancer. A lot of it is diabetes or heart disease, obesity. And by going on what they call a transformation experience, they get off their medications and they heal. And then besides all that, they have the Hippocrates Health Educator Program, HEP it's called. And that is a training for people who would like to be educators basically in vegan living. And so for the first time, we were invited to give a two-day training as part of the larger, I think it's about a three-week training, I think, that these people go through. And they were from all over the United States. They were from all over the world. There was a woman there from Qatar, a few people from India, quite a few from Germany, Norway, different countries in Europe, from, of course, from Canada, all over the United States, some other countries too. And so they're getting a certification. They'll be certified as Hippocrates Health Educators. And it's quite an intensive training. They've got people there at Hippocrates who do a lot of the training. They teach them how not only to do the food preparation, but also everything else to be a successful coach and educator and it's vegan, plant-based, basically raw, sprout-based eating and training and so forth. But quite a few of them were really vegan activists. It was very interesting. There were 32 people going through this training, and so we had them for two full days, all morning, all afternoon, and it was really a wonderful bonding experience that we had with these people, really good-hearted people, some wonderful people we met from one woman from Wales, and they were really fantastic. And I think, we learned also, one of the things that my old Zen teacher said, whenever we're teaching, we're maybe the only one that's actually learning anything. We can learn ourselves by teaching. And I remember, this word vegan, it brought up quite a bit of resistance among some of the people. Some of the people don't like the word vegan, because they feel that what they're doing is healing, and they feel that the word vegan is sort of distracting from that, because all kinds of horrifically unhealthy foods are vegan, right? You can go and buy extremely unhealthy food. You can, you know, like heavily fried donuts with smothered in sugar or whatever. I mean, you can buy all kinds of horrible food that is vegan. And a number of people also do go vegan, and obviously usually not for their health reasons, but they think, well, it's okay, it's vegan, you know, it's okay, it's vegan, you know, leave me alone, it's vegan. And then very often get sick, they don't have good energy, whatever it is, and so they're not very effective advocates either, and then maybe their doctor says, look, you can't keep eating this way, and then they go off, and they said, I tried being a vegan, it didn't work for me, and that's the worst possible thing, you know, when people, from my point of view, it's really the worst thing, because when people meet these people that said that they tried being a vegan, that didn't work for them, and you have to say, well, what were they eating? And so I think, you know, there is a point to be made for, like, T. Colin Campbell doesn't want to use the word vegan. He just says whole food, plant-based diet, and, you know, you bring in the whole food and plant-based. And the thing is that the word vegan is based on an ethic, and it's based on the ancient idea of ahimsa or nonviolence. And so, to me, that actually includes eating healthy foods, because if I'm eating foods that are processed, that is a form of violence, actually. I mean, where do these chemicals come from? Where do these saturated fats, these oils, these genetically engineered oils come from? What is the result of me eating them? If I get sick, I need to have some drugs. Where do the drugs end up? You know, they go through my body. They end up in the water. They end up harming fish. And so everything ends up harm, you know, potentially that's toxic. It ends up harming not just me, but other people. Because if I'm not healthy, I'm usually harming other people in some way. They have to take care of me in some way, or products have to be tested on animals, drugs and things, because I'm not healthy. And then it ends up in the environment, harming animals again. It's animals, it's insects and birds and butterflies and so many of these, you know, bees and fishes and so many animals that are really affected by us not being healthy. So there's different ways of looking at what we name ourselves, and I think that's the hardest thing in many ways, because as soon as we say we're vegan, it is setting up a division, right? I mean, there is a division, like, oh, I'm a vegan, you're not a vegan, so here we are, okay, now we're sort of from two different tribes, and, you know, in the old days, two tribes, usually they were fighting, and that's how it often is, I think. I've been saying that quite a bit lately, that we human beings, if everybody was logical and rational, everybody would go vegan, right? There wouldn't be any argument. I mean, it's obvious that it's not healthy. It's a completely obsolete way of using resources, causing hunger and war and starvation and environmental devastation. Okay, so if you're logical, we just stop doing it and we all go vegan. Very simple. However, we're not logical and rational. It's very obvious that we're not, and we should not say that we are. We have, you know, the potential, I guess, to be somewhat logical and rational, and we have the potential to be intuitive, which is to connect with our own inner guidance, our inner wisdom. But at a much deeper level, we're conditioned. We're really conditioned, and we're conditioned by communities, and in that sense, we're tribal, I would say. Tribal, just meaning that we identify with a particular tribe, and tribes are really oriented, again, primarily around food. Food is the one thing that brings people together more deeply than anything else in a tribal way. And so I think at the bottom of our problem in many ways, as I talked about this in the World Peace Diet, I don't use the word tribal specifically, but that's basically it. The cultural, social conditioning, and from our friends and family and so forth is basically an induction into a tribal, mindset. And so, when we say we're vegans, we're kind of creating an alternative tribe, which is beautiful. So it's a tribe in a sense of kindness and caring and making connections and taking responsibility and using our resources wisely and trusting our intelligence and intellect and making connections. And I think all of those things are healthy, so we're creating alternative communities that are healing and that really are the pathway for the future. And the more we do that, the easier we make it for people who are not in our community to join our community. The more vegan restaurants that are around and meetup groups and movies and and coaches and cooking classes and Sunday evening phone calls and, you know, whatever it can do to create communities of sanity and connectedness. We can call it vegan. But I'm just wondering if there's another word that we can use that doesn't create this sense of us versus them. Oh, you're a vegan, you're in that camp, you think you're better, you know better, and so forth. This doesn't seem to be a problem that goes away very easily. There's, you know, the good thing is that among younger people, the word vegan is becoming much more cool and hip, and I think it's not pushing buttons. But like when we're in India and China and some of these other countries, especially countries that have a very, you know, more traditional family orientation than we have, we're much more individualistic here. So someone can change their food, and it's not quite so shocking to people around them because it's kind of like, well, you do your thing, I'll do my thing. Everybody's cool with that. You know, it's kind of the thing from the 60s and 70s. But I think, you know, in India and China and other traditional societies, Eastern Europe and so forth, if you say you don't want to eat the same food, the other people around you, you can't say that. I mean, it's just like not possible. You do not do that. We all eat the same food, period. That's it. That's how we eat together. We eat the same food, and we're not going to change that. And so it's very difficult. Usually we found in India, if someone was vegan, they get their whole family to go vegan. You know, so you have these family vegan, this whole families of vegan people. It's kind of cool, but it's understandable. It's kind of like, you know, it's very difficult to change for one or two people to just change on their own. And so it comes back to somehow having a way of expressing this to people in wherever they're at, where we're making something available to them that they can transition into. And I think the most powerful tool at our disposal is our own embodiment of these ideals, the fact that we are ourselves healthy and happy and living a life of meaning and authenticity, that in itself makes it possible for our movement to grow, because as we do that, we will positively touch other people and encourage them in the same way. So what it is perhaps not so much a static state. So I just wrote an article, and I hope everybody can read it. It's called a new essay. It's called Veganism, : Our Journey, Not Our Destination. So Veganism, Our Journey, Not Our Destination. Because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in both the vegan world and the non-vegan world that veganism is sort of you just go to this other tribe and then you're there and you're done. And you've heard me talk about this, so I won't go into it right now too much, but just that to realize that we're all on a journey and it doesn't end when we go vegan. We can continue to deepen and mature and evolve and co-create a world of greater wisdom and understanding, and that it really depends on our own creativity and our own resources to contribute to that, and we can always deepen and cultivate our resources and become better activists in a whole countless ways. I think the way we become better activists is by introspection and transformation of our own lives more and more, so that they're in alignment with vegan values. So it's this sort of ability or commitment to authentically being honest in our relationships with ourselves and with the people around us, to do the best we can to always come from a place of kindness and respect in our relationships with everyone, and integrity. And I think that's growing. I think that, you know, that basic idea is growing. People are realizing more and more that there really is something to veganism as a way of living, as a way of showing up in the world. And so it was interesting during that time with the Hippocrates health educators that somebody brought up the idea, because we were talking about this word vegan, and in chapter, I think it is chapter 13 actually, I used the word shojin. I introduced the word shojin, which is the little Japanese word that means the practice of eating or living in a in a way that doesn't cause suffering to animals as a practice. And I was thinking about this recently, that that's a great way to look at it. You know, instead of looking at veganism as a ism, you know, as like a state, that it's more, what we're doing is we're practicing shojin. You know, I'm practicing shojin. You know, I'm practicing, we need a word for it, because the people who are eating meat and dairy, you know, we have these words, like people use the word carnism. I've created the word herderism. People don't think of themselves as herders, herderistic, or as carnists, or as speciesist. And these words that are used to describe the status quo, which is a status quo that is filled with abuse and violence, and we're just normal if we're herders and living in that society. But if we're not supporting that, if we're doing something else, if we're eating plant-based foods, then there's a name for us, right? We're vegetarians, or we're vegans, or we're practicing shojin. And in China, they say we're practicing the world peace diet. I kind of love that one, just because no one can argue with world peace. And sometimes I think we should just, you know, ditch everything else and just say we're world peace eaters, world peace livers. I guess something like that, like we're just living for world peace. And if they want to know what that is, then we can say, well, living for world peace means living a life of respect for all other expressions of life. And, yeah, so as part of that, I don't eat animal-based foods and whole food. It's a whole food plant-based diet. Plant-based meaning not just, you know, mostly plants, but, you know, it is that. It's completely plant-based, because I realized that as soon as I take out my wallet and pay someone to stab or abuse an animal, I'm causing completely unnecessary suffering, and then I'm eating that and inflicting that on others. So that's not it's not necessary, and I would never want to do that. So practicing a way of living that maximizes the well-being of all, I think, and is really kind of what's underlying this ethic, and it's an ancient ethic, and it goes back thousands of years. So as things continue to unfold, we will see this all, you know, it's like a big education process, I guess, really. We're trying to find the words and how to use the words, and we're trying to create, and we're doing a great job, I think, really. All in all, I think we're doing a fantastic job. I mean, we're seeing vegan restaurants increasing very quickly, and the quality and the reputation, really, of vegan food is getting so much better, and it's really undeniable that the cutting edge of gourmet food nowadays is plant-based. This is well understood, and there's lots of things, you know, happening that are positive. I know there's always this phenomenon of, you know, whatever it is, two steps forward and one step back, but a lot of times I think as vegans we create more problems because we don't work on ourselves. You know, we go vegan and then we think that other people are the problem. And some people misinterpret, I want to mention this actually, this is some side point I want to mention, but some people actually misinterpret, I think, or don't understand, or don't really read the world peace diet. But I've heard of the world peace diet, actually, the only criticism I've heard of the world peace diet from vegans is, I think it's because they didn't really read it carefully, but they say that since in the world peace diet, we're talking about how animal agriculture, it's really the driving force behind the underlying, not just the outer devastation, but the inner devastation to our attitudes and, you know, the social injustice, racism, sexism, and a lot of the classism and the problems in our world are actually driven by the mentality of animal agriculture, the underlying mentality of might makes right, of reducing beings to things, and so forth. So what people say is, well, that must not be true, because if that was true, then everybody who goes vegans, you would never have anyone who's a vegan who's racist or who's sexist or who's abusive in any way. And we all know that's not true. There's a lot of vegans who are racist or who are sexist or who are abusive and get angry and get upset and shame and blame and criticize and sometimes physically violent and so forth. So it shows that the world peace diet is wrong, that it's not animal agriculture or something else. So, you know, I have to really say, listen, no, that's not, people who go vegan, it's not like you go vegan and you completely become a complete angel, you know, and you're not, because you've given up eating meat, now you're, you know, totally fully enlightened Buddha-like being. We still have the same, you know, we've made some progress, for sure, but we still need to continue on our path of awakening. That's really important to understand that we're born into a society, from the time we're little infants, we're wounded in a variety of ways. One of them is to eat animal foods, but many of the other ways to just to see others as objects to be used in a competitive economic environment, to see others as objects to be used sexually or to be used to buy something or to be used in some kind of power tripping. These we're all wounded by this, and these seeds have been planted in us in a deep level. So veganism is really an extremely rigorous program of discipline and of inner questioning, and but I love it. I mean, it's like an adventure of discovery, of being willing to let go of old habits and self images, and to work in a system. That's the hardest thing. You're working in a system, a language system, economic system, political system that is totally created by herders, you know, by it's a system on every level created by people who are dominating, exploiting animals. So even the structure of the words, the languages, the sentences, the objectification of pronouns, of calling animals it, you know, and so many other things. It's just layer upon layer upon layer of indoctrination to have us all eating animal foods. And so going vegan is a massive undertaking, really, to purify our thinking, to quiet our minds, to open our hearts into the larger harmony and the vast eternity of our true nature, and to let that shine forth in our lives unencumbered by all the trappings of a hurting society. To free ourselves from that is really it's not daunting. It's exciting. It's like, wow, we can always learn and grow and become better. So certainly going vegan is a great victory. You know, just anyone who says, and I'm no longer going to take out my wallet and pay for the abuse of the other living beings for food or other products, that's terrific. But that, again, that's just the beginning in many ways. It's a significant step on our path, but the beginning of a whole new level of the journey. And now we can really become effective in healing our world, because we're no longer directly part of the problem. We're now in many ways part of the solution. But that does, again, we shouldn't be easy on ourselves and say, okay, now I have the right, since I'm a vegan, to have a huge car or to make sexist remarks about people or whatever, because you're a vegan, it's okay. No. No. And we have to hold ourselves, I think, to an even higher standard. And that's, again, it's a wonderful opportunity, I think, to grow and to learn and to contribute to the movement. Because I think as we do that, we begin to help the movement itself heal, which I think really, you know, is where we're at. Because when money comes in and influence comes in, then a lot of damage is done. And so we can easily lose our way. So I just want to really thank all of you, because I know if you're on this call, you're wrestling with these and working with these ideas in daily life. And I think it's terrific, really, to be able to do that. All right. So if anyone else has any other questions or comments, I think at this point I'd like to, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I did want to go over some of the resources from the last month, and also looking ahead to next month in March. Just to mention also, so I know all of you are aware, probably most of you anyway, are aware that one of our colleagues, Kip Anderson, who went through the World Peace Diet Facilitator training, and when we did it in Cincinnati, probably 7 or 8 years ago before he made all these movies, he's made 2 movies, as you know, The Cowspiracy, the environmental impact, and then What the Health on the health impact, moving to a plant-based diet, the many benefits to our environment and to health. And also it's great because his approach I love, because he does it in many ways like the World Peace Diet, in, you know, showing the deeper structure of the industries involved and who's really benefiting from all of this. And anyway, he and I are in touch, and Madeline and I will be going up to Phoenix, and we'll be meeting Kip Anderson next week. And this is kind of just a between us, but you know, he's working on a third movie. I think it's not a top secret thing. I think people know that the third movie is coming. And as I understand it, it's going to be on the other part of the World Peace Diet, which is the ethical and spiritual and religious dimension of all of this. And so we'll be doing an interview with him for that. So keep us all in your prayers. It's great to see there's other people doing things. Thomas Jackson is a wonderful person who has interviewed us for his film called The Compassion Project. And that's also on the spiritual dimension of veganism. And he also went to India. I think Kip also just got back from India. And so the whole idea is to look at the bigger picture and how the bastions, really, in any society, the repositories of ethics are religious institutions, and how our religions have in many ways abandoned their mission by enabling animal agriculture and the hideous abuse of animals that goes on without religion speaking out against it. And why is that happening? And so I think we really need, again, we need films, books, anything, you know, whatever, articles, art, music, to help shine light on how our spirituality, our ethics, our inner wisdom, a sense of being part of an eternal, benevolent unfolding of life, how that is damaged by animal agriculture, and how veganism, or awakening to our true nature, which is a better word, I think, for veganism, as we awaken to our true nature, that we come into an alignment with the deeper values that are always present, and we create religions and a spiritual path that does what religion says. Religion means to join together again, with to rejoin or reconnect. And that's, I think, a beautiful thing. So we'll be working on that next week with Kip. We'll also be going up to one of our World Peace facilitators in Sedona, Susan, in her Pitcairn, and her husband Richard Pitcairn, a very famous dog authority. He's probably the world's number one authority on dogs. And he's got Dr. Pitcairn's big, huge book on taking care of dogs, and now they're vegans. Susan went through our World Peace Facilitator training, and his newest version, he's really coming into, they're under a huge attack because they're promoting veganism for dogs, and the people in power don't like that. It's amazing how much meat dogs and cats eat. I mean, it's really incredible. You know, I was treating the other day the number of dogs and cats. I mean, it's like, what is it? I think it's like 70 million dogs and almost 70 million cats, like that, and almost like 150 million animals, and they don't eat anything but meat. I mean, it's a huge amount of meat. I mean, huge numbers of animals are killed to feed these dogs and cats, and especially dogs can easily be vegan. Cats in many ways too. So I think, you know, it's great that people, veterinarians, are beginning to help again to, you know, shine light of compassion and wisdom onto the situation. So anyway, we'll be going up to Sedona, doing a few lectures up there in Prescott. April Wilson, who's also a facilitator going through the program, is helping out arranging these things. And also in Phoenix, I think there's a vegan spirituality group there that's helping out. And then that'll be kind of it for a while, I think. We'll be in March, we'll be back in California working on some more projects, doing quite a few interviews, actually. And then in April, going to Southern California again. We've got quite a few. You can just go to our website to see our schedule. We are planning on going to Europe again this year. And we've been invited to Portugal to speak at a conference there, and to Greece, speak there as well. So if you look at, if we just look for a minute at the resources for February for 2018, we see the two essays that I just wrote recently, Awakening from Scientific Rituals, which talks quite a bit about my, the experience that we recently had in San Luis Obispo at the Cal Poly, and how young people are so easily, unfortunately, manipulated by their idealism to then support a system of violence. Veterinarian or food science and so forth, animal agriculture gets, it's just woven into everything. And then also the new essay, Veganism, Our Journey, Not Our Destination, some videos. I have a new short video on fish and ocean devastation that was co-produced with the vegan publishers. And our good friend Phil Nicodissis, who's a facilitator, went through our training recently in Hawaii. He's now traveling the world and giving lectures promoting veganism, really a very much the world peace diet approach. He just did one in Japan, if you want to get a sense of that. We're actually working with people in Japan to get the world peace diet translated into Japanese. He's been a wonderful, you know, he's doing this this program where you spend a different month in a different country every for 1 month for a year. So 12 different countries in 12 different months. And so he was with us in India, and then he was in several different countries, but in the Czech Republic and also in Portugal, and now in Japan. In all three countries, he's helping to coordinate the translation of the World Peace Diet into those languages, which is really great. I really so appreciate that. So it's great to see what he's doing. He's now in Thailand. And then also Sandra Higgins, another World Peace Diet facilitator, is just doing amazing work, continuing to, with her Go Vegan World billboard campaign. It's so interesting that the officials in England, the dairy industry basically complained that these billboards are lying, that they should not be allowed, they should be banned. And so advertising, the official governmental advertising board that reviews advertising to make sure that it's not lying, told the dairy industry no. I mean, everything that these billboards say is absolutely true. So it's just it's a huge win, I think, really, for the animals, because it allows, you know, these billboards are having a huge impact. And we saw when we were in England that, you know, the vegan movement is really growing, and these are going everywhere, all over the world now. I mean, not only in Europe, the United States, we saw recently, I think, in Australia, you get these, they're going everywhere. Very, very powerful. So thank you, Sandra. She's an amazing force. Also, Bandana Chawla, she's from India. She's an MD. She and her husband is also an MD, and they've just started a new plant-based physician website. This is fantastic news, as well as a new nonprofit called The Peaceful Planet, which is totally vegan-based. They're based in Texas. So it's great to see these new things happening. There's a list here also of all the veg fests in the United States and worldwide. This is a tremendous new phenomenon in the last few years, just having veg fests. Veg fests are a great way for any activist in any city to create an event that just brings in a lot of people who are just curious on some level and learn about the delicious foods, or learn about the ethical dimensions, and really learn. A lot of them go vegan. And so I really highly recommend promoting veg fests in whatever community you live in, if it's appropriate. I mean, you know, if it's the type of place where that would be a good thing. There's also the news about James Cameron's new movie, which I'm really excited to see, called, I think it's called Game Changer. And he's probably the premier filmmaker of our time, and he's a vegan. You know, it's just amazing, fantastic. And some great other films and videos and music here. The Vatican has billboards encouraging people to go vegan for Lent. I mean, right in Vatican City. I think that's fantastic. And another very interesting article on how children with higher IQs are more likely to go vegetarian. It's an interesting connection there. It's also a map of veganic farms in the USA, and so I think this is a very important movement to have foods available that are not just organic, because organic you can still be using manure and bone meal and blood meal, but to have access to veganic produce. And besides growing it ourselves, they create a larger and larger web of veganic farms. And so there's a map now, and hopefully it'll continue to grow. Also, this documentary film, Seaspiracy, we were interviewed for that, so I guess we'll probably be in that at some point. There's a new documentary trailer, and at some point that film will probably be coming out. This is an amazing another documentary called Deadly Dairy about the dairy industry in India. I think it's a very important film. We were just in India, and I think it's so important for people to be aware of this this new documentary. There's also a vegan warrior training with Sarah and Christopher. These are people who have interviewed me, and they've also interviewed Madeline. They're wonderful people, vegans, and they're quite spiritual, and they've created a training to be a vegan warrior. So they're putting that on the internet. Very interesting. And a great article by Serena Farb. She's a friend of ours. Her parents, Joanne Farb and Joe Farb, they live in Lawrence, Kansas, where Judy Carmen lives, and they have three vegan kids, and they're very articulate. And so she wrote a great article. She's in college now. My parents forced veganism on me, and how grateful she is that they did. And it's a very perceptive article, I think. So anyway, there's some more, quite a few other, I think, very important articles. Meat and dairy consumption, how they're destroying Earth's wildlife. Yeah, Salesh Rao, also, he's a friend of ours. He's here in Phoenix. He's got the Climate Healers website. Great article on the weight of animals and how I talk about this quite a bit, how we've destroyed the biomass and biodiversity of the animals, free-living wild animals on this earth by eating animal food. It's very important to understand this. Rabbi Shmuley, he's in Phoenix. He's also going to be interviewed for this new movie by Chip Anderson. So he's got an article, Can Houses of Worship Commit to Going Plant-Based? He's a vegan rabbi. It's great to see that this is becoming a trend. There's more and more vegan rabbis. And this is, again, very positive. And anyway, I think that's some more here. I won't go on too much more, but I highly recommend if you have a chance, please check out the these articles, and it's a great way to learn and be informed about what's happening in our world and in our movement. So I want to, I think I'll go ahead and wrap it up here. It's been an hour and a half. Madeline has been knitting here while I've been speaking, and she just handed me the latest creation. I think this is maybe the last one. She has been knitting so many of these wrist warmers. They're vegan, of course, wool. They're not lamb's wool, and they really are selling like mad. I mean, every time we give a lecture and she's wearing them, people buy them. And so she's knitting and knitting to keep up with the demand. We sold them in Florida even, and people just love these. Like, they're wrist warmers. They're called Pulse Family. They're knitted, and you put them on your wrist. They're like ankle warmers, but for the wrists. They're maybe, 3 inches long, I would say, and they're beautiful colors, just gorgeous, with little buttons on them. And you put them on, and if it's a chilly night, you just feel much warmer because all of the meridians pass through the wrist and all of the pulse and so forth. So, yeah, there is on our website, there's photos, and if you want to have a look. But I think we're pretty much sold them all out. I think we only have, I don't know how many sheets. I think we only have 3 pairs left, and she's made, I think, probably close to 60 pairs over the last few weeks. She's an amazing knitter. She'd be the Olympic knitter, I think. Anyway, she just handed me, this is the very last pair she's going to make from this, I guess, this year. So here they are. So anyway, we wish all of you a warm, happy month that we can together continue to raise the flag of veganism. Somebody just
raised their hand. Maybe I'll quickly unmute. I know we really need to end here, but wireless caller, who's this?
Hi, this is Antoinette.
Hi, Antoinette.
Hi there. So I was there last night. I introduced myself. I'm one of the people I think you referred to earlier that heard you speak 3 years ago in Tucson, and I was so moved by what you said that I just had a shift, and I went vegan on the spot. I just wanted to say I also bought a pair of Madeline's wrist warmers, and they were wonderful. I wore them today, and they kept me warm, and I only wished I'd bought every pair that she had so I could have given them as gifts to all my friends. They're gorgeous. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Internet. Wow, well, that's beautiful to hear, and she has, Madeline has a big smile on her face.
Great.
So you're not okay. Rolling them. All right. Bless you. Thank you.
You too.
Yeah, thanks. So much love to you. Also, the next third Thursday, we'll go back on our Thursday schedule. It will be March 15th, the Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March, but not in this case. This will be good. And March 15th, at the usual time, we will get together again. And I wish you a terrific month. All our love and best wishes are with you. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to be in touch with me between now and then, or if there's anything you want me to address in the following month's statements and in the circle call, just let me know. And I guess I'll go ahead now and we'll begin to wrap it up. I'll just play a short piece of music here. Why don't we, let's see, what would be a good one? This is a nice one. We haven't played for a while. This is called The Turkey Song. It's from our album called Animal Songs. Much love to you all. Thanks. Good night, everyone. Thank you.